Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by the Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, proud B Corp, using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. VSAC helps students of all ages save, plan, and pay for college and career training with education and career planning services, need-based grants, scholarships, low-cost education loans, and Vermont's official 529 college savings plan. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. Norwich Solar Technologies, providing complete clean energy services to Vermont schools, towns, nonprofits, and businesses. Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as the Green Mountain Club. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. And nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Arlie Russell Hochschild is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley and one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She is the author of 9 books, including her latest, the New York Times bestseller, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. In that book, she travels to Louisiana, the second poorest state in the country, to explore why its neediest populations both rely on federal aid and reject the concept of big government. She went there to gain a better understanding of the Tea Party, the staunch anti-government Republicans who morphed into the heart of Donald Trump's base. Arlie Russell Hochschild, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, great to be here, David.
Well, let's start with the most obvious question from the work that you've done most recently. Why are people who are most hostile to government often the ones who are most likely to need it?
Well, that's the red state paradox, and it's a paradox not just in Louisiana but across the whole country, that it's the poorest states, the states with the most troubled families, lowest life expectancy, most pollution are also those states that, as you say, take more money from the federal government in aid than they give in taxes and hate it. And then the question is why. And what I found when I asked people, just the question you're asking, why, they would say, well, we know that we're poor, we know we take money from the federal government, and we're ashamed of it, but it's not the main thing. So they kind of acknowledge it. There's even a Cajun humor about, well, we're, you know, at the bottom in education again, ha-ha. You know, there's kind of a humor about that. But it's at bottom, I think the answer is they feel like something more important is going on, and that more important thing is their own downward drift in life. They feel like they're part of a sector that has lost with globalization. And I tell their story through something I call the deep story. What is a deep story? A deep story, you take moral precepts out of the deep story. You take information out of the deep story. It's a distillation of feeling. It's what feels true. And I think we all have a deep story, but the right-wing deep story underneath this red state paradox, it has to be told like a dream. it's kind of like through a metaphor, you're standing in line, long line, as in a pilgrimage, facing the top of the hill where you see the American dream. And in the right wing deep story, your feet are faced forward. The line hasn't moved in years. Many people said, look, I haven't had a raise in 2 decades. You know, I'm about ready to get retired. You know, I don't think I'll ever get there. And the fantasy is I don't have any grudges against any racial group or gender group. It's just that my feet are forward. I've worked hard all my life, and this line isn't moving. And the right-wing deep story, there appears a line cutter. Well, who would that be? That would be a black who, through federally mandated affirmative action, finally has access to jobs that have been reserved for whites. And even worse, there's a woman who cuts in line in their perception and finally has access through federally mandated affirmative action to jobs that have been reserved for men. And then other line cutters seem to them to be immigrants, refugees, and even the Louisiana state bird, the brown pelican, that has been decimated by oil and petrochemical waters. It seems to, you know, with its dripping wings, to be stepping ahead in line. Oh, the environmentalists put animals ahead of people. So another moment of this right-wing deep story, there's Barack Obama waving to the line cutters. Oh, he's their president, not mine. And I'm being pushed back. The government isn't preventing this. Let's find a new place. We are strangers in our own land. And in the last month of research for Strangers in Their Own Land, I went to a Donald Trump rally in New Orleans, and the excitement of these white, older, highly religious Tea Party people and others was palpable. And I realized that I had spent 5 years studying the dry kindling, and now I saw the match. So that's why the Donald Red State paradox fled from mind for them.
What led you to want to travel from Berkeley to the Bayou to learn this story?
Well, you know, I'm a liberal Democrat, and I live in a Berkeley, California, you know, which is generally liberal Democrat territory. I live in a bubble, a geographic bubble, coastal city, a media bubble. I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Mother Jones, and the electronic bubble. You know, I open my laptop and I get myself back again. So I wanted to get out of my bubble because I sensed, and already in 2011 when my project began, I sensed there was a growth of the right, that there was a steam behind it, and I just didn't understand it, didn't know anybody in it. And, you know, also, I guess I believe in bridge building. I believe that it's possible to take one's alarm system off and permit oneself a great deal of curiosity and interest about people who you imagine are fundamentally different from you. That's an exciting thing to do, I feel. And so
Do you come away from Louisiana and your travels there affirmed or doubting, having more faith in that bridge-building possibility or less?
What a good question. I think the circumstances that call for such bridge building at every level of society have made bridge building ever more urgent. It's become, since 2016 when the book came out, more important. And because there are bridge destroyers, I mean, as we speak, you know, Bannon is now back in play and trying to get Republicans to confront Democrats and dismantle the impeachment hearings and so on. So what is that? That's, that's a bridge destroying, I think, at the highest level, Trump himself. So it's more urgent. But I think I do feel heartened that it is possible. And actually, just 6 months ago, I went with a PBS team that back to Lake Charles, Louisiana, and Paul Solomon, their economic reporter, re-interviewed some of the people I profile in the book. And with us there was a young man who met all these people and has now started a bridging organization called High School Exchange Program. And what it does is get high school kids in Lake Charles to spend 3 weeks in families in outside Boston, Massachusetts, and those Boston kids will be placed in Lake Charles homes. And the organizer, David McCullough, is now extending it. And I've given him the names of all the people I've met, and in hopes of increasing the volume of this bridge. Everybody is ecstatic at the program. He's gotten funding for it, and it's really beginning to take off. But there is now a whole umbrella organization called the Bridge Alliance that has within it some 70 or 80 different organizations with names like Better Angels, that's a Seattle group, or High from the Other Side, Living Room Conversations, daughter started by Joan Blades, who is a mediation lawyer. Mm-hmm. That's now a national program. She was co-founder of MoveOn.org. So there's a lot.
I mean,
lot
what's
going
remarkable
on.
Is you're describing something that in the past we've associated with foreign exchange, or, you know, during the height of the Cold War, you know, these Soviet exchange programs where Americans would go there and they would come here. But this is within our own country. It's the foreignness
exactly.
is
yes.
that profound.
That's right. Exactly. The foreignness is that profound. And, you know, just this weekend, Adam and I had as a guest here in Berkeley a woman that I describe in the introduction to Strangers. She sells medical insurance to people in the dreary plants outskirts of Lake Charles, and she came with her two children. This will be her third visit. She is hardcore Trump, and her son is hardcore Bernie Sanders, and we had a really interesting set of conversations over the weekend. Just left. My head is still swimming. Anyway, it is even in the
same family. Let me just interject.
Family.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Vermont Conversation. Our guest this half hour is Arlie Russell Hochschild. She is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of many books, her latest being the New York Times bestseller, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. So, Arlie, I'm interested in these exchange programs. I won't call them foreign exchange programs, though they could be. Who do you think is in for the bigger shock, the kids going from Louisiana to Boston or vice versa?
I think vice versa, because the kids in Louisiana, and I would say it's also true in the rural Midwest, know better what's going on coasts, because they feel marginalized and they feel overlooked and obscured by history. So they kind of know what is going on the coast better than the coast knows what's going on in the South and Midwest.
Now, this is actually the subject of a recent op-ed you wrote for The Guardian, in which you argue that Democrats are far more politically sheltered than Republicans. Explain what you mean and what the implications are of that.
Yes. This was in reference to a new national sample, a new national survey done, sponsored by Common Dreams, that found that both some non-surprising and some very surprising stuff. The non-surprising stuff is that Democrats and Republicans each stereotype the other. In other words, when you ask Republicans, what proportion of Democrats do you think believe that all policemen are bad people? And Republicans would estimate, 50% of Democrats believe that. It's 15% of Democrats think most policemen are bad people. And on the other side, when you ask Democrats what proportion of Republicans think there's no race problem in America, and Democrats estimate, half of Republicans think that. Well, no, it's 15%. In other words, 85% of Republicans say, no, we've still got a problem here. So each party stereotypes the other, and this isn't a surprise. What's a surprise is that education, being highly educated, does not help in reducing this level of stereotyping the other. Among Republicans, the most educated were no better at getting it right about what Democrats think than were the least educated Republicans. And here's the zinger, on the Democratic side, the least educated Democrats were three times more likely to get it right what Republicans thought. In other words, actually among Democrats, being highly educated was a disadvantage in getting it right about what Republicans thought. So I thought, wow, what's going on here? And I think the answer is that Democrats are more tightly wound in their cultural bubbles than are Republicans, who are more likely to have neighbors who are Democrats and to kind of know what Democrats think. So it's also true that a Pew study found that Democrats believe in diversity, and they believe in getting to know the other. They don't want to live in a bubble. They don't believe that's the right way to live. So, but paradoxically, because they are largely urban, largely professional, they do live in bubbles. even though they don't believe in doing so. And they reflect the bubble effect. And that bubble effect is so strong that it cancels out the advantages of higher education.
So we're now watching, over a dozen Democratic presidential contenders essentially trying to come up with the answer to the question, you know, how do we reach people who are disaffected? How do we peel away the people who find Trump's messaging so powerful? So you've seen this up close. You've been with folks who support Trump passionately. What would your advice be to some of these Democratic candidates about how to, you know, what is the message that would resonate?
I think the message that would resonate is, a lot of Americans have been hurting and under the radar. It's not been part of the Democratic narrative. I mean, Clinton made it look like, well, we're doing fine, just need a few fixes, let's keep going ahead the way we are. And the people I came to know were saying, no, things have actually gotten worse in a lot of ways. So to speak to that, if I were, for example, Elizabeth Warren, I wouldn't start with, here are the policies we need. I would back away and say, there are things that have happened to you that have not been your fault. You know, I think the people I came to know felt shame at a kind of that they were on a downward trajectory, culturally downward, economically downward, religiously downward. In other words, Elizabeth Warren or whoever it is, I think needs to say something, to be animated by the realization that from the 1970s on, globalization had winners and losers, and that the losers have felt forgotten. And the elite of the losers, that would be who I think I interviewed. That's who the Tea Party is. That's who these big Trumpers are. They're not the abject poor, but they are the elite of a losing sector, the Rust Belt, South, and they feel marginalized. They feel like they're religious, but religion is kind of culturally denigrated. They have social values that are seen as sexism and racism and homophobia, and they feel morally, you know, that wagging moral finger of the North is scolding them again. And they feel even their body type is the wrong body type, and that they're low educated. They can't get the great new jobs, and doesn't look like they will. So she has to, or whoever it is, needs to back up and say, "Don't be ashamed of that. Things have happened that that aren't your fault, and here." We're with you in the journey forward. To speak to the distress and shame of people who've felt so like strangers in their own land.
Well, Arlie Russell Hochschild, I want to thank you for joining us this week on The Vermont Conversation.
My pleasure, David.
Arlie Russell Hochschild is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of the 2016 bestseller, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.